Welcome back, listeners. My name is Jackson Vickery, and I am the host and producer of the JV Club podcast. On this episode, I spoke to BAFTA-nominated hair and makeup designer Sean Miller about their work on Saltburn. Couldn't be more thrilled to chat with you. How are you?
I'm really well, Jackson. Yeah, it's really nice to see you again. It's been 2 years, right? I think.
I know. I was like, yeah. I went back in sort of the time portal of just where you were, like, or where we were 2 years ago. And it's so wild because, like, I think I posted right before you were BAFTA nominated or BAFTA longlist. I couldn't exact because it's Instagram was saying 96 weeks and I was like, I can't do the calculation of 96 weeks ago. So I was just like, oh, kill it. But then the post after was, I mean, it was the BAFTA list. So I was like, oh my gosh. And I'm just like, that's absolutely nuts. Because then I just remember, I mean, chatting you about every small thing that was happening because I was like, oh my gosh, red carpet. Oh my gosh, this. Oh my gosh, that. Oh my gosh, this. And then, I mean, Saltburn comes into play and I'm like, oh my gosh. And I just, like, I couldn't stop shutting up, to be honest.
Yeah, the BAFTA thing, that was a big, big surprise to me, big shock, but incredible. Yeah. I'm
so deserved.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it was yeah, overwhelming. It was really weird, actually, before Christmas, I think the Academy Awards, whether they call it the long list, the short list came out.
Yeah.
And that was my first shock to get into the final 10. I don't think I've ever been as nervous in my life as doing the Bake Off. Oh, it's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. And then, of course, then the BAFTA shortlist came through and then the nomination. That all happened actually. I was on a Netflix job. And so at the beginning of that job, I was in prep and I got the nomination. And then towards the sort of midway through the job, once we started shooting, I got Saltburn. So I was just on a natural high. I mean, wow.
Yeah, I mean, talk about the natural endorphins just rushing through. Yeah. My gosh.
Yeah, super lucky.
Before just diving into Saltburn, I mean, talk to me about the Bake Off because everyone loves hearing about the Bake Off.
Okay.
I have to hear what that experience, I mean, I didn't get to chat with you about it. So
we had to do it online, of course, because we're on the back end still of COVID. I think by then we were probably in lockdown in the UK anyway, lockdown version 3. Alessandro Bertolazzi and Laura Solari and myself, obviously, you know, talked about, you know, what we were going to do. I mean, it's like what we have a big department store in the UK called John Lewis. It's the church of the middle classes. The show The Apprentice, you know, I liken this to being on The Apprentice and pitching your product to John Lewis, and you've got about 3 minutes. And that's what it felt like. It was just kind of like, you know, and of course, there's so much you want to say. And there's three of you, and they say to you, you know, you've got about 14 minutes or whatever it was. It's just the anticipation, you know, I'd not done anything like that before. I'm not going to lie, you know, it was, and to be, in that arena with such incredible, artists from all the other films that year, it's kind of overwhelming. I'm not ashamed to admit it. You know, I did feel very, very lucky to be there. And, I since met Linda Flowers actually when I was in LA a couple of weeks ago, and I said to her, she's one of the governors of the branch, and I, you know, I said, I've never been so nervous in my life. Anyway, Yeah, I've grown up a bit since then, but
No, I mean, it is wild. I mean, Cyrano was just kind of, I mean, who knew? I mean, just from, I mean, it's such, I mean, I still think so fondly of it. Last night, I went and did a late night screening of Wish, that animated Disney film. And there's just, I don't know, there's just something so special about it, about musicals and just about movie musicals, seeing them on the screen. And I don't know, I just, after, I mean, it was so weird watching that and sort of thinking of Cyrano afterwards and sort of prepping for the interview. But I don't know, there's just something so magical that I just think about that film randomly, and just it holds such a special place. And
I think I'm a little bit like Saltburn. It had a really tight crew, and I think obviously led by Joe Wright, but then with Seamus McGarvey, Sarah Greenwood, and Massimo Cantini-Perini, and also Jacqueline Doran, who did Hayley's costumes, and myself, you know, I felt that, you know, it was a very cohesive group of people. And Saltburn had the same feel. And I think when you get that in very genuinely, it really does show with the tone of the film. So I feel like that showed with Cyrano, you know, on screen. And I think it the same with Saltburn. I think there's that kind of, I don't know, we gelled, and it looks like it, I think.
No, it all just, everything just fits together. It's like a beautiful mosaic, but so grand, but it works so.
And we had that, on Emerald's film, if not even more so. I mean, it was just it's just the most incredible experience I think I've ever had. I mean, I remember saying to you, obviously we've kept in touch on and off, and you know, when I read the script, I thought, this is the best script I've ever read. And you were like, wow, that's quite a statement. But it was such a page turner and so evocative of, you know, the mood that we've ended up with on the film, you know, on starting on the page, you know, it just came to life. It was just, and I couldn't put it down. There was no, oh God, I got to read that bit again. It was just, and you don't get that all the time, sadly. You don't get that often. So it was, really, really amazing to read.
But I mean, talk to me about that call that you get. I mean, in the middle of this Netflix show, in the middle of sort of coming off this crazy whirlwind of Cyrano, and maybe it's more unexpected than you thought, and then here you are getting offered something from Emerald Fennell, who, I mean, who just has this first sort of powerhouse punch of Promising Young Woman. And I'm just curious what that's like, because I mean, she could have gone anywhere and done anything sort of after that film. And I'm just curious what it was like just in that moment, because I mean, she's coming off this high too.
Well, I have to thank Mandy Martin at Milton Agency, who represent me, because when I joined Milton and I explained to Mandy, you know, what I was interested in doing, I think, you know, she really tapped into that, and I think was definitely looking for a project for me to follow up from Cyrano. And I got a call from her, and she said, right. Yeah, and actually it was on the eve of the BAFTA awards ceremony. It's a Friday night. I think it was the eve of the nominees party. I was just about to start shooting the show I was on, the Netflix thing. And what I didn't realize is I was starting to feel a little bit groggy that I was actually going down with COVID. But anyway, that aside, I read the script. She phoned me up and said, look, I've got this Emerald Fennell script. So of course I was instantly eyes wide open. I knew Promising Young Woman, of course. And she said, I just really think this is for you. So I read it on my iPhone, which normally I wouldn't read it on, and I, you know, I wear glasses, and I just couldn't put it down. So I was lying in bed feeling a bit groggy, thinking I need to get an early night. I've got a big weekend. And I just couldn't put it down. And I think, you know, by the time I got the script late, fairly late in the evening, it was probably one in the morning when I finished it. And I thought, I have to get this job. I have to get this job. I don't think I've ever been quite so hungry for something. And then, you know, once I finally was able, Emerald was very busy with casting. So 2 or 3 weeks of kind of like missing meetings, all of which were going to be probably via Zoom because we were still in that. It's like kind of she was busy. It wasn't so easy to go meet people. We were still wearing masks at work and all of that stuff. So finally, we got a meeting arranged, and I think we just bonded over the Emerald's vision. It was very much all the research that I'd done. I'd done a lot of prep. You know, I read the script 2 or 3 times. I'd broken it down immensely. You know, I'd done a lot of research and put down a lot of ideas. And I think it was just a meeting of minds. I'd worked with Barry Keoghan before. You know, we both shared a love of The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which is a great film. You know, I think a lot of the ideas I had for the characters, we were on the same page. I did wait about, I think, 10 days until I heard, and I got word of it. I noticed a message popped up on my phone from my agent, Randy, and I managed to listen to this voicemail just offset whilst they were going for a take. And then I did a lot of air punching in silence and literally couldn't believe my luck. I was so thrilled beyond, you know, my wildest dreams to have landed the project. I think she had seen Cyrano and she really loved it. So, I mean, that definitely helped, of course.
Just wild.
Yeah.
But I mean, talk to me about, I mean, obviously the script is a page turner. I mean, it plays, I mean, I can only imagine just reading it without any sort of seeing any of the vision that would then come down the line. But I'm curious and once again, it's a loaded question of who popped out to you, but who were you drawn to in that particular moment? I mean, reading at 10 p.m., 11 p.m.
Yeah.
And who was the character that had that sort of stickiness that you just couldn't get off the mind?
I think Venetia. Definitely. I had really kind of that just evoked lots of ideas in my mind's eye about what she could look like. I mean, all of the Cattons, of course. Oliver with his transition, which is kind of denoted to a degree on the page. I mean, at the beginning, the way Emerald described him with the self-styled Zac Efron-esque kind of hairstyle. And then at the end, he's described as this urbane, beautiful man. So I knew taking him from sort of late teen, kind of still very boyish look through to, you know, what I would call the Cary Grant, or Barry would prefer to call it a Paul Newman. But anyway, that at the end. So definitely how to do that, and knowing Barry and how we would work that out. Of course, poor dear Pamela, Elsworth, all of the Cattons, and also just to set the scene, the background, you know, all of the amazing crowd that Laura Allen so brilliantly made look like they were grounded in that mid-noughties 2007 period. I just had so many images in my head of how, because it's, even though it's 21st century and it's relatively contemporary, it's still a really distinct period in time. And they give it another 30 years, it'll be, you know, thought of as a period, you know, like the 80s and 90s now are. You know, you'd need a little bit of time away before we can classify it as a period look as such. But nonetheless, it's still, even though it's still only 16 years ago. So yeah, lots and lots and lots of thoughts. And then of course, I knew that we had Rosamund Pike. I knew that we had Barry. And then it was just a waiting game to find out who else we'd get. Yeah. And then, of course, that affects.
Yeah, I mean, but talk to me also about 2007 Sean. And who was 2007 Sean?
Well, 2007 Sean. 2007 Sean was 40. And I had my first baby in 2007. So 2007 Sean was working in British television. As much as I very much, you know, I love fashion and I keep a keen eye on it. I'd got to that kind of age where, fortunately for me, I wasn't wearing hair wefts that were half falling out at the back of my head. And I wasn't doing, I like to think I wasn't doing bad Saint-Tropez tan. And I think being born in the 60s, I kind of tattooing, I kind of, that had passed me by a bit. Anything rock and roll I've got is multiple piercings. So, so yeah, but I've always been really into the music scene. So, I was very much, you know, aware of kind of what was going on around me. But of course, that whole teen popular culture, which a lot of my own team on this are millennials. So they were the age of Oliver and Felix in 2007. They're all in their 30s now. So I tapped into their original kind of their experience, as well as all the normal avenues of research. Because I think the period that you are in your sort of late teens is very optimum in one's life. For me, it was the 80s. So that really sticks in my head. So, yeah, so that was me in 2007. I'm not going to lie. Being a very old mother. Well, I forget the medical term, but anyway, so, yeah, that's where I was at. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just 2007. I mean, I think about 2007, and I think I was in maybe going into high school at that time.
Yeah.
And so when I was watching the film, it's like, I mean, obviously you're looking at Barry Keoghan and Jacob Elordi and you're just kind of like, oh dear God, like these godly creatures. And yeah. I mean, it was almost like I was back in middle school again, where it's just like this little closeted kid who was just like staring up at the sky, just being like, oh my gosh, who are these, like, who is this God? So I can only, like, yeah. I mean, imagine sort of like the Barry Keoghan sort of just taking on the Felix sort of aspect of just like, who is
that? Yeah, I think man? I was looking at it, actually, how I looked at 2007 when it was 2007 is probably a bit like people that weren't maybe of that optimum age to have experienced that kind of that shared experience of those teenagers, those late teenagers. It's probably like the same thing, looking through a window slightly, in the same way that you know, we will look through that window, unless you were kind of in it, of the period we've just been through with the eyebrows and the stripy contouring, and you know, fortunately I wasn't sucked into that, because I think age, if you pass that bit by, you may have got off lucky. So I think I got off lucky with the 2007. You know, my son now has got this fringe thing going on, a 2023 fringe thing. It's kind of a bit like a ski jump. And we will be putting that into movies in 15, 20 years' time. And all his friends have it. You know, it defies gravity. I don't quite know how he does it. I'm not sure I could style it like that. You know. So I think the 2007, it's like, it's almost, my experience was like looking in through a window at the youth.
Yeah.
Crazy things they were doing.
Yeah. And I mean, it's fascinating to think about what Saltburn would look like in 2023.
Yeah.
Now. But what I find so interesting also about 2007, and I'd love to hear your thoughts in terms of this, when it comes to the fact that, I mean, we're in this period where they're really, phones are a thing, but they aren't a thing to the degree that we're at. And I'm curious what that do in terms of designing for these characters, because so much now. I mean, like you've been saying, I mean, we kind of, we get our inspiration or our,
yeah,
our world from the outside so readily. I mean, TikTok, Instagram,
yeah,
I can go on your Instagram, literally go through slides. Like, this is the inspiration behind Felix or behind Oliver, or yeah, behind Venetia. And you can just sort of replicate things like that. And, yeah, oh, I want to look like Felix, or I want to look like Oliver. So I'm just curious, what was it like sort of taking back the lens and creating characters that, and I mean, you're obviously, you've done this before in terms of with Cyrano, yeah, but I mean, like you said, I mean, 2007 is such a distinct period where we're on, yeah, the cusp of something so sort of transformative in terms, yeah, of we're idolizing, we're getting, mm, into the period, but, mm, we're not quite there. So I'm just curious how that sort of impacted some of the characters.
It most definitely did, because I think the iPhone came out in 2007. So up until then, you know, and that revolutionized, you know, the sharing of images. So Facebook had only been, I think, around a couple of years. So in terms of social media platforms, I mean, Facebook was ruling the world. So that was a great source to go back to the beginning of Facebook, because, you know, I joined Facebook and it was very much the sort of the preserve of the youth, but it was like, it was clearly a thing. So that was something that I could tap into. So there were that, you know, a plethora, and I know Sophie Canali did the same thing. There's a plethora of our costume designer. There's so many images there to tap into. But other than that, what I did was I went to, you know, magazines, the music scene, you know, popular youth culture, television, film, you know, whether it was things like Mean Girls, The OC, High School Musical, Over Here, Celebrity Big Brother, you know, it was just so many people, so many sort of pockets, genres, because reality television became quite a big influence around that time. So I tapped into all of that, you know, looking at, you know, in the same way that you would with the 18th century, just looking at all the avenues available for researching. But of course, I think the world somehow seems much smaller and accessible now we have the visual social media that's just everywhere. And it's so easy, in fact, to just go to Instagram and always, when I teach, is to say, you know, it's not a good idea. You want to go sort of look at paintings, look at books, look at old movies, etc. So that was something. But also, I think because Emerald, her mood boards are incredible, and we were drawing from influence from a lot of places, whether it was old movies, whether it was painters, whether it's Caravaggio or Gainsborough, whether it was Stanley Kubrick, Barry Lyndon, whether it was Death in Venice, whether, you know, Chiaroscuro, you know, the Gothic, the vampiric. So I think all these things fed into the mix, along with the key things that Emerald was very keen, really, really wanted to get in there. Like, for example, you know, Felix, who's beautiful but incredibly uncool. So, you know, the Livestrong bracelet, the bootcut jeans, the rugby shirts, the eyebrow piercing, which has just been listed in the top 10 most sartorial moments in film by Vogue, British Vogue. So there you go. which I thought, oh, that's good, which I think Emerald had to fight for. You know, the tattoos, the Carpe Diem tattoo, all the kind of things that we look at and we think, oh God, that's so naff now. It's just, so there were, you know, all those elements that we wanted to bring in, the hair extensions, you know, Venetia, it's high lift bleach, it's broken, it's brittle hair. And you can see their extensions, you know, there's no disguising that. So, you know, there were all those things that we wanted to introduce. But then also knowing that we were going to be playing around with light and shade and the format, the 1:3:3 format, that we were going to shoot incredible close-ups, and that Emerald wanted to see the pores, the sweat on the skin, the flushed cheeks, the flush of youth. And as much as everybody has makeup on, the guys have makeup on, you know, knowing that whatever we did to them to transform those characters, we had to do it super fine, super invisible, because we knew that we were going to see this massively in close up. So yeah, it was a real mix of all sorts.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I love the film. I mean, I love the film for so many reasons, but I love just its references to highbrow and lowbrow culture. I just think it's, it melds so beautifully where, I mean, it's just like, you look at someone like Richard Grant's character and you're like, what life has he lived? Who is he? And then it's like, then you get a son like Felix and you're like, how did he become him? Or like, how did he, what was his childhood like? So I just find that so incredibly fascinating, and just sort of putting those together is just,
yeah. And I think what it needed to be with the highbrow lowbrow is it needed to have be grounded in reality. So as much as they live in this incredible stately home with 127 rooms, we had to look at the Cattons and see real people, incredibly entitled, incredibly wealthy people, with this great ancestral line that goes back, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, but they had to look real. So from the hair and makeup design point of view, I had to make them look kind of accessible. So I wanted to see hair. I wanted to see, which is something I like to see anyway in my work. I didn't want any sense of artifice to kind of get in the way of their characters. So it was really important to give them all looks that felt kind of very real and just to support and help to shape the character, but not to stand out and take over. And I think that's the same in any period film. I think the moment we see the artifice and the ringlets or the powdered wig or the hair extensions and the bleach, the moment it takes over and we're very aware of the hair and makeup design or costume design or production design, whatever it is, then I think that's the moment we haven't lost ourselves in the story, we've lost it, you know, and we're looking at the things as separate parts, and it needs to be the sum of many parts for it to work. So I think that was important. So for example, with Rosamund Pike and Elspeth, the ethos there was that she'd done runway, she'd been a former model, she'd had her hair pulled around and created into all sorts of fabulous things by other people. And she's incredibly beautiful and she has amazing clothes, but it's effortless. So it's the same. It's not, she's not putting on a hair show. It's just the same, unless it's a Valentino dress. But even then, it's kind of relatively casually put up. And it's kind of understated, because there's nothing that she doesn't need to make a visual statement with her appearance. It's not showy. So that was really important to have that kind of subtlety about her. Whereas Venetia, it's vaguely masking her insecurities and the fact that, like her hair, she's very brittle. There's all sorts going on there. And she's lonely. She wants some attention. So there's a lot of, there's dress up, as there is with Carey Mulligan, with poor dear Pamela, who the brief there was she should be uncomfortably dressed from breakfast through to dinner. So with her, you know, that the look is so standout, because again, it's very much a mask. And then all her tattoos are all storytelling tattoos. There's lots of Easter eggs in here, in the tattoo design, which was all hand drawn by me. We made all the tattoos in house, and they all kind of tell a story. So whether they allude to her, you know, her drug abuse, the floating molar, that's her nightmare of losing her teeth. There's the playing cards, the dice, the horseshoe, which is the horseshoe slightly inspired by Amy Winehouse, of course, from the period. But they're all to do with luck and the fact that she's not lucky. And then there's the lucky in the horseshoe, which is a little nod to Lucky Chap. So I've got that in there. there's the capsule on her arm. It's like a big kind of capsule pharmaceutical, which sort of was inspired by all the backstories that Rosamund and the cast and Carey would kind of work out whilst they were running up to turnover, and would really encourage this. So Rosamund, you know, the line about along came Jarvis and common people, and everybody thought it was written about me. So she sort of devised a bit of a backstory that she'd maybe been out with someone in the Stereophonics, and then Carey had decided, well, I've been out with Richard Ashcroft. So that, it says the capsule that's got R Ash, R dot Ash, and that's Richard Ashcroft. And it's in the Damien Hirst from the pharmacy era of the time inspired capsule. So that's on her arm, and there's a dagger for revenge, and then sort of dice again, but they're in the position, they're like the Russian mob ring tattoos on her arm. So, excuse me. So, and then of course the heart with Daddy in, so make of that what you will. the story, you know, as does Alison has, so Venetia has a mirror. She has mirrored tattoos to her brothers. They're very close. We never quite know how close. And their stars, were, which are derived from the star in the family crest. And then where Felix has a Carpe Diem linear tattoo on his inner arm, we have a matching position on Alison's inner arm, on Venetia's inner arm, which I didn't want anybody, you blink and you miss it, but I didn't want anybody to freeze frame and kind of decipher some kind of Balinese language or... So that's actually derived from the Shepherd's Pie scene and the pie mathematical sequence. Because I just sort of, you know, just to play on words. So that's 0.141, just so I drew it on the back of an envelope and thought, right, that's roughly what we'll do, is just swirly writing. And I'll probably post something about that, actually, so people can see it more closely. I mean, you wouldn't know looking at it, but that's where that comes from. So I think it's the old art school progression of thought, you know, how you can take one thing and then turn it into something else just through a few steps of evolution, which is always quite exciting to do, I think, when you get the option.
I mean, we're talking about this accessibility aspect, because I mean it really is true in terms of the sense, I mean, even though I don't know Rosamund Pike and I don't know Elspeth, but I feel like I know someone in my life like her, so that I think that's where it also works extremely well, where I mean there's just the commentary on society is just out of the world. But it is like I feel like you know these characters, or you know someone like these characters. So I think maybe that is one of its strongest sort of winning points, in a sense, is you kind of feel like an Oliver when you're rolling up to the house and you're just kind of like, wow, okay. And you just follow him along because you're just sort of beady eyed and just as, I don't know, just as entranced as he is in this whole process. And I think that, I mean,
I think we all had that. I think we all had that moment when we first visited, you know, the first time I went down the mile long lane and approached the house. I just couldn't believe it, because I filmed in most of the Stately homes, certainly, well, in fact, all over the country over 30 years, lots and lots of them. And I've never been there. It's a privately owned house. It's not open to the public, and very much had an Oliver moment. But yeah, I think actually the good point to make is going back to about the accessibility and the social commentary. That's why I think with Archie Madikwe's character, Farley, with his hair, which is actually half of that is added on, it's a half wig. I looked at black hair from the time, and there was a lot of cropped hair. With a lot of the women, we're still seeing a lot of straightened hair, you know, all the politics of hair. In fact, Lady Daphne's character that we see in the karaoke scene, you know, I felt that actually a little bit like, oh, it was Michelle, forgotten her surname, from Destiny's Child that she would have a kind of a chemically straightened kind of look. And I had a wig made with a kind of a slightly crinkled top to show that kind of a covering, just to show that kind of texture that you get from relaxing hair. But I felt with Farley that he's grown up in the States, he's grown up in New York, he wears eclectic clothes, and as much as he's, you know, he's, and it's, and it, it talks about it in the script, he's very much an outsider in that world. And there's the scene with Felix where he says, you know, I have to come to you with a begging bowl, how does this look, you know? And then he talks about the footmen, and Felix doesn't even know who these footmen are. And those are the two, the black footmen that we see at the beginning when Duncan opens the door. So it's very much, there is a commentary there as well on, it's on society and race as well. And where is Farley's place here? You know, there's there's charity there, but then suddenly there's not. And it's all just incredibly misplaced. So with him, I really wanted to embrace the texture, the natural texture of his hair. I thought that was really important for his character, because he isn't a follower of fashion and he very much knows his own mind. So, you know, I wanted to get that across, which I think really helped as well with that whole, like you said, with the whole kind of the commentary on society and status and position. It's very deep. Yeah.
And talk to me about the house party scene.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, not just scene, I mean that segment of the movie, because it is, I mean, talk about alluring. I mean, you really see, I mean, we've touched on the transformation of the Oliver character, but you really see that I, at least for me, that's when I really start to see this shift. And I mean Barry Keoghan has probably the best size I've ever seen in my entire life, and so I'm curious when it came to, I mean, especially for him in that particular moment in the film, I mean, what was written in I think the white costuming is just so gorgeous, and the antlers that are coming off his head are just gorgeously obscure, and just, yeah. I don't know. So I'm just curious, what did you, I don't know, how did you sort of like get into that version of Oliver? Because it's so hypnotic while being so obscurely strange.
Yeah, he started to shapeshift the moment he kind of got in with Felix at Oxford. So he loses that kind of Zac Efron, super flat, neat kind of comb to the side, bang or fringe as we would call it here. So he started that kind of shapeshifty thing. And then because, you know, it's hot, it's the middle of summer. So, you know, we want him to look like he's getting quite wrecked. You know, there's a scene where it all goes really wrong and he ends up in that kind of room where it's like a club and all the lights are strobing and it's kind of blue and it's red and Felix has told him to get lost and nobody wants him. So I made him very sweaty. You know, he's very shiny. He's got really super flushed cheeks. You know, his eyes are kind of popping. So that was what I did. I mean, they're all, in fact, in there. There's a lot of, you know, there was sweat galore everywhere, with all the pub and the club scenes. You know, it was showing that kind of heat and that flushed thing was very important for Emerald. So that was something that I did for Barry to really show at that point, you know, because, of course, when we see him approaching Felix at the Minotaur, you know, we don't really know where this is going. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, we think he's not out of his mind as an insane, but we think, you know, he's completely off his rocks, you know. So I used the makeup techniques to try and show that with what was happening to his skin and the color of his skin, you know, like I said, the sweat, you know, and then we think he's going off to throw up, but, you know, then of course,
right.
So So that and that was something that I did there, and then just showing that, and then of course we get to the later stage where I played around as well with I used on his skin. So for the sort of the early days, you know, he has makeup on in all of it, but I played around with the tone, so it's much more natural. It's a bit paler to begin with, and then as we move through the story, and then when we get to the older Oliver, it's a darker, he's more tanned, he's definitely more groomed. There's a subtle bit of aging in there as well, just to try and show that transition with the quality of his skin, the tone of his skin, to take us through his story arc.
Yeah, it's I don't know, I felt for his character in that moment in particular, because I don't know, you, it's just fascinating, because I can't exactly describe it, because it is so interesting to I mean, I've never been in a situation like that before, but in terms of what's happening in the film, but to feel like that in that particular moment, it just, it, the sweat just kind of like chirps off his face onto I don't know, just onto the floor of the movie theater. There's just something so, I don't know, it's almost like oh gosh, what are those pop-up books where it's just they're leaping off the screen, where it's just, I don't know, it's wild what this film, I mean, and
What he does is terrible, but then there's the sympathy, because of course the Cattons are actually terrible people. You know, the way they consume people, the toys, the playthings. You know, poor dear Pamela, she's redundant suddenly. They're bored of her. They want her gone in the early hours when no one can see. The way they pick people up and then discard them. You know, Elspeth is just a phenomenal character for her quips and her just put downs. It's, you know, all the lines about the, you know, she'll do anything for attention. And then, with, you know, about poor dear Pamela, and then her own daughter, you know, about the anorexia. And it's not as if it's even worked, or it's not as if it's working, or whatever the line is. You know, it's just dreadful. So I think there's you know, there's kind of sympathy with the devil in this film, with the kind of the gothicness of it. It's very interesting how it plays around with your emotions and your empathy as the story unfolds.
And I mean, just in our final few minutes, so you've done Paddington.
Paddington
24. But yeah. I'm very curious. I mean, we kind of touched on this very early on in the chat, but I mean, who would have imagined that, I mean, Saltburn could have been on the mind of like, this is the film that I have to do next. This is the film I'm meant to do. I can't stop thinking about it. So I'm curious, what is next for you? What is something that is, you just have to get your palms on to do? What after Saltburn can you, I mean, do? I mean, you can do a thousand things, but.
Interesting. I think there are two things I would love to do: a Western. I'm not particularly into horses, I'm not going to lie. I love to do a Western. I read a script a while back for a Western, and the timing didn't quite work out, and then I got Paddington happened, and which was amazing. And I'd love to do a horror. I'd love to do, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, do you know what? I don't know that I'm open to any genre. I think so much of it is about, it's about the script, it's about the characters. And I think, you know, films like this where there's so much involved. They're so rich. There's so much detail. Anything like that, of course, isn't that what we all want? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a bit of a generic question, but I was just, I don't know. It's like, after given an opportunity like Saltburn, it's like, where now? Because I feel like everyone is kind of like, well, now what? So I don't know. It's, I'm curious, like, where could you take a Western? Where could you take a, where could the Sean touch be? Because I mean, like putting it on Cyrano, I mean, that's, I've never seen anything like Cyrano before. So it's it's
incredible. So, I mean, yeah, something that I think anything that whether the group of people that you're collaborating with have the same kind of ideas about creating the same kind of slightly raw, you know, very real, very grounded kind of work. Is what I like to do. So I think that that's it really is just sort of hoping that you can come together again with that, you know, where, and also to work with directors. I was very lucky with Joe Wright and with Emerald Fennell, you know, where, you know, they have that degree of autonomy for their vision. So, you know, not to be kind of dictated to by, you know, and it is horses for courses, but by a massive kind of committee of you know, people controlling the look, because it becomes more homogenized somehow, I think, with the more people there are. And I think when you have directors, strong directors that have that level of autonomy, then you know, they really set the tone, and that's just a remarkable thing to be part of if you're lucky enough. It's fabulous. Be working for a living for sure.
Yeah. And final two questions, if I can bother you.
Yes.
Okay. Is there a character in Saltburn that you most relate to, and why?
Gosh, that's an interesting question. I'd say it's probably Farley.
Interesting.
I think because Farley is an observer. He's a people watcher. He's not missing anything. He's taking it all in. And, you know, he's quite witty. I think he's kind of, he comes across, you know, we think he's actually being mean, but I don't think he is necessarily being mean. I think he's just observing. He's no fool. He very much knows how things work. He has an understanding of the situation, I think. So I think, you know, I'm a people watcher for sure. So yeah, maybe Farley.
And then final, truly final question. If you could describe this film in three words, what is it, or what are those three words?
Okay. Hot, both senses of the word. It's hot, it's gothic, and it's funny. Hot, gothic, and funny. All of that.
I love it.
Mix all that up together and you've got Saltburn.
Put it in a pot and this is what you get.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, this has just been the absolute dream, absolute pleasure, absolute honor again to be able to chat with you. I obviously am way too much of a fan of yours, but I have to thank you so much for
thank
everything.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure. It's so nice to see you again.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. This podcast was hosted and produced by yours truly, Jackson Vickery, but a very special thank you to Sterling Gavinsky for the theme music,
and to Carly Haney for the artwork. We will see you next time.